individually in death, my power is continued.
On the morning of October 23, 1998, 52-year-old Dr. Barnett A. Slepian returned home from his local synagogue following a memorial service for his late father. Born in April of 1946, Dr. Slepian was the son of two first-generation Soviet immigrants who started a family in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He first graduated from the University of Denver with a degree in zoology, then dedicated himself to the study of medicine at Mexico's Autonomous University of Guadalajara. After finishing medical school, Dr. Slepian settled in upstate New York and opened up a large private OBGYN practice in the city of Buffalo. The practice offered a wide range of full-service care, from pap smears and infertility treatments to prenatal and delivery care. Dr. Slepian proved very popular with his patients, who spoke of his warmth, sincerity, and skillfulness in his work. But among other circles, Slepian wasn't just unpopular. He was downright despised. As a result of his work providing abortions, Dr. Slepian was targeted by some of the most vicious anti-abortion activists in the country. Protesters from all over the United States descended on Dr. Slepian's practice. Some picketed silently, others were far more vocal. Pig, murderer, and monster were just some of the abusive names directed at Dr. Slepian. But the man himself tried to keep politics, religion, and medicine separate and focused on providing care to the women and girls who needed it. He brushed off the protests with his signature dry sense of humor and often soothed the fears of nurses and other employees by bringing baskets full of fruit or baked goods into his practice. "He was tremendously collegial to me personally," said one of his coworkers, "dropping everything and rushing to help me during my first week when a patient worried me. Moreover, rather than criticizing me for interrupting his day, he complimented me on my concern." It's not clear if Dr. Slepian was attending his late father's funeral, or rather a special Hebrew commemoration service known as Yahrzeit, that takes place on the anniversary of a loved one's death. But either way, the service had taken place quite early in the morning, with the doctor returning home at around 10 a.m. Dr. Slepian walked into his kitchen and began heating up a pan of soup as part of a late breakfast. Then, as he worked a wooden spoon around the base of the pan, the small glass window in front of him shattered, and a sudden force hit him squarely on one side of his collarbone. After Dr. Slepian fell backwards, collapsing into a crumpled heap on his kitchen floor, there's a chance that he was only conscious for a matter of seconds before he passed away. The bullet that tore through his throat not only burst several major blood vessels, but it also shattered his spine, leaving him completely without feeling from the neck down. A painless death might have made for a small mercy, but it was completely overshadowed by the fact that Dr. Slepian's young son, who was sitting at the kitchen table just feet away, was forced to watch his father's death. It was only minutes later that the boy's mother became aware of the situation, and she rushed to dial 911. But by then, it was too late, and a man who'd spent his morning grieving the loss of his father had been tragically sent to join him. "Make no mistake," said New York's Governor George Pataki, "this is an act of terrorism, a cold-blooded assassination. It is beyond a tragedy, and Dr. Slepian will be missed." Down in D.C., U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno promised the federal government would do whatever it takes to track down and prosecute whoever is responsible for this murder. Attorney General Reno also stated that she and her colleagues were actively investigating the possibility that Dr. Slepian was murdered because of his work providing family planning services. "The federal government will continue its vigilant defense of constitutionally protected rights to provide and to obtain reproduction health service." In the weeks before Dr. Slepian's murder, he'd been visited by members of the FBI, who'd warned him of a chilling, credible threat to his life. In previous years, four other abortion doctors had been the victims of lone sniper attacks, some in northern New York and others in far eastern Canada. But despite being warned that he too might become a target, Dr. Slepian refused to be intimidated. Given that his murder matched the criminal characteristics of the preceding four attacks, Police very quickly assumed Dr. Slepian's murder to be the work of radical anti-abortion activists, and in particular, those under the sway of Minister Philip Flip Benham. While those on either side of the abortion debate have traditionally called for peaceful and productive dialogue, Benham has publicly eschewed pacifism in all of its forms. "For anyone to take it upon himself to be judge, jury, and executioner is nothing but sheer evil," said Karen Pryor, who formerly ran for Lieutenant Governor of New York on the ticket of the anti-abortion Right to Life Party. Benham called her attitude pitiful. "Unless abortion is outlawed in this country," Benham once said, "we are in store for more bloodshed in the streets, the likes of which will sicken even the sturdiest among us." The FBI reportedly approached Minister Benham in the aftermath of Dr. Slepian's murder, but were told they were barking up the wrong tree. "Slepian has been a killer for a long time," Benham supposedly said, "but I can't support outright murder, and I'm sad to learn of his death." In fact, Benham hadn't heard rumors of snipers or assassins in any of his evangelical circles, but what had reached his ear is that a certain website seemed to have learned of Dr. Slepian's death before any other, a website belonging to a group known as the Lambs of Christ. According to Flip Benham, within less than an hour of Dr. Slepian's murder, a chilling update was posted on the Lambs of Christ webpage. It was a simple black-and-white JPEG depicting Dr. Slepian's name, but with a line drawn through it. Alternatively known as Victim Souls of the Unborn Child Child, the organization was founded by Norma Westlin in 1988 and went on to become recognized as one of the most aggressively militant anti-abortion activist groups in the world. In 1992, Time magazine described the Lambs of Christ as the most zealous and aggressive of the pro-life organizations, and detailed the tactics they used in the hopes of shutting down every abortion clinic in the United States. Activists would often attempt to blockade family planning clinics, chain or glue themselves to doors or equipment to disrupt the clinic's operations. At one point, Westlin encouraged his followers to apply quick drying concrete to their hands or feet, disregarding the horrifically painful chemical burns they'd suffered during the process. "The longer it takes to cut us free," he said, "the longer those killing machines are off." The FBI began investigating the entire Lambs of Christ membership roll, establishing alibis for each and every one of them, at least all except one. Not a single person has seen 44-year-old James Charles Kopp since Thursday, October 22nd, and when federal agents knocked at his house in St. Albans, Vermont, no one was home. Somehow, Kopp was the only member of the Lambs of Christ to slip through their fingers. To better understand the man who had quickly become their prime suspect, FBI agents began digging into his professional and criminal histories. Kopp had once been a professional musician, playing his trade up and down the California coast. But around the same time he mysteriously disappeared, Kopp had been working in construction while renting a room in a rural farmhouse. There are a lot of indication of some level of involvement, and certainly enough to believe that he has information about the Slepian murder, said a senior federal official. But at this point, we do not have evidence that ties him to the shooting. If we did, we'd charge him. However, that wasn't strictly true. Not only did the police have plenty of anecdotal and circumstantial evidence that Kopp owned a high-caliber hunting rifle, but it was missing from his residence during an FBI search. The owner of the farmhouse where he rented a room said Kopp would often hunt with it and would also use a powerful telescopic scope to aid his accuracy. And what's more, FBI agents recovered evidence that Kopp had been authoring a number of extremist pamphlets on behalf of a group called the Army of God. The pamphlets included instructions on how to build improvised explosive devices, as well as other methods of disrupting or destroying family planning clinics. One particularly disturbing section of the pamphlets detailed how operatives should amputate the thumbs of abortion doctors under the assumption that they'd no longer be able to do their jobs. Each pamphlet acknowledged someone named Atomic Dog as being integral to their creation, so the FBI set about investigating this person's identity. Back in 1988, Kopp had once spent a brief spell in an Atlanta jail cell after he and several other radical anti-abortionists were arrested for harassment and assault. Kopp's fellow inmates at the time included Oregon homemaker Shelley Shannon, who was later convicted of shooting a doctor in Wichita, Kansas. However, the person he associated with the most during his brief incarceration was a man named John Arena. Arena was based in New York State and, along with a conviction of throwing butyric acid in the faces of clinic workers, was also said to have compiled a large list of East Coast doctors involved in performing abortions. The FBI checked Atlanta's extensive prisoner database and quickly located Kopp's file. There, under aliases, was the nickname Atomic Dog. The FBI soon discovered that Kopp had not only been jailed in Atlanta, but also up in his current home of Vermont. He had been arrested back in 1990 along with another anti-abortion activist named Loretta Mara. The pair were said to have continued communication following the brief 2-month jail sentence, with Kopp paying several visits to Loretta's home in the New York borough of Brooklyn. Yet it wasn't until they realized who Loretta's husband was that the true significance of the friendship sank in. You see, Loretta's husband was none other than Dennis Malvasi. Dennis grew up in East New York during the early 1960s and shared a small apartment with his mother, stepfather, and 11 brothers and sisters. Unfortunately, sometime around the age of 10 to 12, his mother sent him to live in an orphanage upstate. The time at the orphanage was rough on young Dennis, so much so that the U.S. Army seemed like a preferable alternative. At just 17, he convinced a stranger to fake his father's signature on a parental consent form for recruitment and was shipped off to Vietnam. Incredibly, Dennis enjoyed soldiering so much that he volunteered for a second tour. However, much like many of his fellow veterans, he found adjusting to life back home to be just as tough as life in a war zone. Dennis found his rhythm by becoming an actor, possessing a clear and observable talent. Yet sometime back in 1975, Dennis was stopped and frisked by an NYPD officer while waiting on a subway platform, and a .25-caliber pistol was found in his pocket. Dennis received a 2-year sentence behind bars and grew incredibly bitter over the experience. He had served his country, and all he had on him was a small-caliber firearm, whereas draft dodgers had their jail time canceled by governors trying to win votes. The letters he wrote to his family from prison heavily referenced his time in Vietnam, and through reading them, it became clear that Dennis saw his jail time as just another part of his war. After he got out, Dennis was no longer interested in acting. Instead, he became something of a recluse and became a licensed pyrotechnics expert. He said the explosions reminded him of Vietnam, and although he was certainly one of the stranger individuals on his crew, he was good at his job, and so the boss kept him around. It was around this time that Dennis started spending time with a group of Catholic traditionalists known as Our Lady of the Roses. The group shared a disdain for the modern Catholic Church, or what they referred to as Vatican II, and how it seemed to tolerate sinfulness of contemporary society. But in their minds, the biggest sin of all, the most offensive affront to God Almighty, was abortion. Dennis had heard his fellow Vietnam vets being called baby killers, while the same people who spat on them applauded abortion doctors as brave and righteous. To him, the hypocrisy was sickening, and combined with the bitterness that he felt over his incarceration, Dennis became more and more radicalized. On December 10th of 1985, a small pipe bomb exploded inside a bathroom at the Manhattan Women's Medical Center. 11 months later, a much larger pipe bomb blew a hole through the wall of the Eastern Women's Center. 2 more bombings rocked the city of New York over the weeks that followed until finally, on December 14th, the NYPD bomb squad defused a huge dynamite-based device in the 2nd Avenue headquarters of Planned Parenthood. Had it gone off, it would have leveled the entire building. The manner in which the bombs were constructed bore the hallmarks of a highly motivated professional. There were military-grade blasting caps, laser-accurate timers, reliable batteries, and one more thing, a Catholic medal of Saint Benedict, the patron saint of students. Dennis spent the first few weeks of 1987 hiding from the police. He joked about how inept they seemed and how he could most likely make it to Mexico before they even knew he was out of the city. However, an unexpected intervention cut the manhunt short. The Archbishop of New York, Cardinal John Joseph O'Connor himself, appeared on a nightly news broadcast and pleaded with the bomber to turn himself in. The next day, Dennis walked right into the New York headquarters of the ATF and turned himself in. "It's hard to turn down the Cardinal," he reportedly said. After pleading guilty at his trial, and considering that he had never actually hurt anyone, Dennis was sentenced to just 7 years in prison. His defense attorney told the judge that Dennis had made sure that his bombs detonated out of business hours to ensure destruction of property but no loss of life. After Dennis got out of prison for a second time, he continued with what he now saw as his life's work. Within just a few years, he met the woman who would become his wife, Loretta Mara. Once the FBI had connected the dots between James Charles Kopp, Loretta Mara, and her husband Dennis Malvasi, they paid the couple a visit at their Brooklyn residence. It quickly emerged that Mara and Malvasi had provided shelter to Kopp in the aftermath of Dr. Slepian's murder, and that they had also given him cash to get to Mexico. Both were said to be delighted that the FBI had been too late in figuring out their plan, as Kopp had undoubtedly crossed the border days or even weeks earlier. The FBI rushed to coordinate a search with the Mexican authorities, and in the coming weeks, FBI advisors would work with dozens of Mexican federales in tracking Kopp's movements. They believed that he was bedded down with a group of fringe Catholics who shared the same violently anti-abortion stance as he did. However, in reality, Kopp was already on the other side of the Atlantic. Sometime during the opening months of 1999, Kopp landed at a small regional airport in the Republic of Ireland. He presented the immigration clerk with a false passport stamped with a temporary work visa. The clerk approved the entry permit and welcomed him into the country, having absolutely no idea who he had just met. At first, Kopp worked menial jobs to afford food and rent, but he soon found better wages as a temporary typist at the City of Dublin Skin and Cancer Hospital. Colleagues later recalled how he adorned his desk with religious statuettes and claiming to be visiting Ireland as an ancestral pilgrimage due to his Irish background. However, Kopp had no Irish heritage. It was all just part of his ruse. Just as it says in the Bible, what is done in the dark will always come to light. An FBI informant finally discovered how Kopp had fled to Ireland. Mara and Malvasi had initially been released without charge, but after the FBI placed an informant close to them, it was only a matter of time before they let slip. Yet perhaps the most curious thing is that despite FBI agents being dispatched to Ireland under the strictest secrecy, they arrived to find that Kopp had already fled the country. Kopp had apparently departed Ireland on March 12, 2001, after spending two whole years in the country completely undetected. Irish anti-abortionist groups later insisted that they had nothing to do with it, and if they had known Kopp was hiding amongst them, they would have reported him immediately. The question remains, how did Kopp know that he had been sniffed out? Only high-ranking members of the Irish police and government would have been aware of the FBI's arrival, and although the exact date of their arrival is unknown, Kopp certainly seems to have been one step ahead of them. Either Kopp had some kind of sixth sense, or someone tipped him off. Kopp then spent just 2 weeks on the run in northern France when he was arrested, found with not one, but two fraudulent Irish passports. The arrest came after a detailed search of Mara and Malvasi's computers uncovered an ingenious system of communication. Kopp was sending messages to the couple via the draft section of a Yahoo email account the trio shared. Kopp would type up a message, save it in the drafts, and then Mara or Malvasi could log on, read the draft, and then delete it before writing their own. Without any actual emails being sent, there was no traffic to monitor. This is partially why Kopp remained undetected in Ireland for so long. Yet once the system was compromised, and the FBI could read every single exchange, Kopp was tracked down by French police. On March 29th of 2001, Kopp was arrested while trying to withdraw money from a small rural post office. He was said to be extremely gaunt and emaciated at the time of his apprehension. His evasion of justice had undoubtedly taken a heavy toll on him, and he made no attempts to resist his detention or his eventual extradition. On March 11, 2003, Cop waived his rights to a jury trial, knowing there wasn't a jury in the land who would find him innocent of Dr. Slepian's cold-blooded murder. He told the presiding judge that he had never meant to kill the doctor, and only intended to wound him enough to, as he put it, put him out of action. However, the excuse didn't hold up with Judge Michael D'Amico, who noted that Cop's terminology gave away his mindset that he was a combatant on an ever-shifting moral battlefield. "But what appears righteous to you," D'Amico said, "is immoral to someone else." With that statement, Cop was sentenced to the maximum penalty of 25 years to life imprisonment. Cop eventually appealed the sentence. In June of 2007, he chose to act as his own legal counsel when he claimed Slepian's death was a full-bore 100% tragedy, but not murder. Murder means shooting him in the head, blowing up a car, riddling their body with bullets like they do in movies. That's how you kill someone. What became clear throughout the course of the appeal was that, despite almost a decade having elapsed since he took a man's life, James Charles Kopp still believed that shooting a man at the base of his throat did not constitute attempted murder. It was this kind of intellectual dishonesty that proved fatal to his chances of a successful appeal. Judge Richard Arcara later told him, "You served as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. You decided that you know better than any law." On that note, he upheld Kopp's life sentence, dismissing every point of appeal that he'd raised. The subject of abortion is an extremely controversial topic, both in the United States and the wider world. Some wish to see the reinstatement of Roe v. Wade, while others have celebrated its recent repeal. But no matter where we stand as individuals on this or any other controversial subject, violence is not the answer, nor will it ever be the answer, because there's no changing a dead man's mind. Born on March 13th of 1945, Christopher Bernard Wilder was raised in the Australian city of Sydney. He was the eldest child of an American naval officer and an Australian mother. And although very little is known about Chris's formative years, one incident stands out among others. At one point during his early childhood, Chris almost drowned in some kind of swimming accident and required mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. His parents were elated that he survived such a close call, but Chris was never quite the same afterwards. He became highly withdrawn, worryingly antisocial, and viciously violent. His parents hoped that he'd grow out of such behavior, but instead, it grew worse. As Chris entered his late teens, he was hanging out with some very bad people, and in January of 1963, he was arrested in connection with the assault of a 13-year-old girl. It was discovered that Chris had essentially kept watch for two older men who were the assault's primary perpetrators, so due to his age, he escaped with nothing but probation. Chris would later claim that the Australian government forced him to undergo electroshock therapy as part of his probation, but no such records of this therapy exist. By the age of 23, Chris appeared to have gotten his life in order. He was engaged to be married. He was working a steady job, and he had plenty of prospects in life. Yet just a week after his wedding, his wife of just 7 days filed for a divorce. It's unclear why she chose to do so, but some suspect she discovered something Chris had hidden from her during their relationship, something which terrified her utterly. Her departure signaled a marked decline in Chris's mental health, and as a result, his criminality began to reemerge. The following year, in November of 1969, Chris somehow managed to obtain nude photographs of a 19-year-old student nurse. It's possible that this was the first time Chris employed what would come to be a tried and tested technique, one that involved winning a girl's trust by claiming to be a modeling agent. Then, once he had the pictures, he made a clumsy attempt to blackmail the girl and was reported to the police. At first, the girl seemed keen to press charges against Chris, but for some reason, she changed her mind just a few weeks later. Again, it's not clear why she chose to back away, but it's more than likely that witness intimidation played a key factor. Chris had dodged justice, but his reputation was in tatters. Many of those close to him had long suspected him of harboring dark proclivities, and the swirl of media attention all but confirmed it. In the end, Chris simply decided to pack up his things, move someplace else, and start all over again. Then the following year, he did just that. During the summer of 1969, Chris arrived in Boynton Beach, Florida, to a completely fresh start. He bought a large beachfront property around 25 miles south of Palm Beach, Florida, and entered the local real estate business to roaring success. Within just a few years, Chris presided over a small real estate empire and became a very wealthy man as a result. He regularly vacationed to Hawaii or the Bahamas and indulged in a rather expensive interest in photography, which involved converting one of his home's bedrooms into a large, state-of-the-art darkroom. But while wholesome on the surface, Chris's new hobby was far from innocent, and rather than use it to express himself creatively, he used it to document his heinous crimes. For 4 years, Chris stuck to roughly the same approach. He'd walk around with a smaller handheld camera, then approach an attractive girl while claiming to be a modeling scout. He'd take a few snaps of her, tell her how pretty she was, then asked if she wanted to stop by his home to shoot a free portfolio. A depressing number of young women were too naive to refuse him, and as a result, many fell victim to his predatory ploy. Once back at Chris's house, the girls were usually intimidated into posing for more and more risque pictures, until finally, he chose a moment to strike. Despite several convictions for assault, Chris never received any jail time for the offenses. We can't speculate on why that is, but we know that following one such incident in 1977, Chris was forced to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. Incredibly, the psychologist claimed Chris was unsafe except in a structured environment and made a note of his dangerously misogynistic attitudes and opinions. Chris continued to harass and violate young women throughout the late 70s and early 80s, including two 15-year-old girls during a visit to his native Australia. Two other girls later identified Chris as the man who had abducted and violated them in Boynton Beach, Florida during the summer of 1983. The fact he continued to avoid any real justice despite two decades of sickening assaults is nothing short of maddening, and in one case, the continued delays to one of his court dates allowed Chris to keep on offending. But it wasn't until early 1984 that Chris's lust turned to bloodlust, and what started many years before as a despicable deviancy became nothing short of a maelstrom of bloodshed. On February 26th of 1984, 20-year-old Rosario Teresa Gonzalez disappeared from her job as a pharmaceutical spokesmodel at the Miami Grand Prix. She was last spotted departing the track between noon and 1 p.m. with a Caucasian man in his 30s. Her blue 1980 Oldsmobile Cutlass was found a few days later parked near DuPont Plaza, and when police dusted for prints, they discovered someone had wiped every surface clean of fingerprints. Then on March 5th, Chris's ex-girlfriend, a 23-year-old Miss Florida finalist named Beth Kenyon, vanished without a trace. She had recently turned down Chris's marriage proposal on the grounds that there was too large of an age gap. Much like Rosario Gonzalez, her car was found abandoned a few days later, and it was discovered that both women had participated in the Miss Florida contest. On March 18th, Chris lured 21-year-old Teresa Ann Ferguson away from the Merritt Square Mall. It's not clear how or why she was murdered, but her body was found just a few days later in the Canaveral Groves. Next to be targeted was 19-year-old FSU student Linda Grover. She was abducted from the Governor's Square Mall in Tallahassee, Florida, then driven across state lines to Bainbridge, Georgia on March 20th. Chris had initially approached Linda by using his old modeling scout ploy, but after declining the offer, Linda was beaten, restrained, then confined to the trunk of Chris's car. When they arrived at the Glen Oak Motel in Bainbridge, Chris used superglue and a blow dryer to bind her arms and legs together. Then once she was immobile, he wove copper wire around her feet and toes, then passed an electric current through them to induce mind-shattering pain. There's no doubt that Linda would have suffered the same fate as the other girls, if not for a valiant and unexpected escape attempt. At one point, Linda felt a surge of adrenaline when Chris turned his back on her, and she somehow managed to throw herself into the motel bathroom before locking the door. Chris was infuriated and promised to kill her once he broke his way into the bathroom. Linda raised all hell to prevent that from happening, kicking the bathroom walls and screaming until her vocal cords hurt. The gambit paid off, and when Chris realized his potential victim was directing undue attention upon him, he fled the motel after stealing several of Linda's belongings. Knowing he could no longer operate on the southern east coast, Chris drove down to Texas on March 21st. The same day he spotted 23-year-old mother and nursing student Terry Walden. Once again, Chris tried to entice her into a free modeling shoot, but after he was turned down, he vowed to punish her for the refusal. 2 days later, he kidnapped her, violated her, and then stabbed her to death, with her body being found dumped in a canal on March 26th. The day before Terry's body was found, Chris had abducted a 21-year-old woman named Suzanne Logan from the Penn Square Mall in Oklahoma City. He then drove her almost 200 miles north to Newton, Kansas, where they checked into the Interstate 35 Inn. Chris seems to have secured Suzanne's compliance by telling her that, if she cooperated, her life would be spared. Chris delighted in the deception and seized on the opportunity to take her life as they approached Junction City. It was a newly developed way of ensuring maximum fear and confusion in his victims, as without that intense terror, murder didn't thrill Chris in the way that it had the first few times he took a life. After fleeing Kansas, Chris arrived in Grand Junction, Colorado. He met 18-year-old Cheryl Lynn Bonaventura on March 29th, and the pair had dinner together in Silverton, with waitstaff overhearing that they were headed to Vegas for a short vacation. The following day, the couple were spotted at the Four Corners Monument, a tourist attraction which marks where the states of Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah meet. Chris and Cheryl then booked a motel room in Page, Arizona before moving on to Utah and the Kanab River. It was here that Chris decided to break the news that he intended to kill Cheryl, and again, it's safe to say that he prolonged the process for maximum psychological effect. Cheryl's body was found on May 3rd, but by that time, Chris had moved on to Vegas alone. On April 1st, Chris picked up 17-year-old Michelle Korgman from a modeling competition at Vegas's Meadows Mall. Some believe that after placing poorly in the competition, Michelle was a ripe target for Chris's modeling scout ploy. Her body wasn't found until May 11th, when the stench of death was detected at a Southern California rest stop, but it's believed the same grim pattern unfolded. Chris showered the girl with compliments, won her trust, then delighted in the terror she exhibited once he suddenly and fatally turned on her. Before leaving California, Chris took 16-year-old Tina Marie Risico hostage, with the intent of using her as bait to lure other young women into traps. He drove Tina back east through Arizona, Missouri, and Illinois, and it was around this time that Chris was placed on the FBI's most wanted list. On April 10th, Chris and Tina arrived in Merrillville, Indiana, where he put his sinister plan into action. It worked after Tina lured 16-year-old Donette Wilt into Chris's car. He locked the doors, drove off at high speeds, then incredibly, directed Tina to take the wheel. She continued driving all the way to New York State before Chris finally ordered her to pull over to the side of the road. He then dragged Donette from the back of the car and into a secluded wooded area near Penn Yan. She was beaten, violated, and stabbed twice in the chest before being abandoned. However, after driving just a few miles down the road, Chris had a sudden moment of doubt. He became convinced that Donette had survived the attack, so he doubled back to make sure she was dead. He walked into the woods, counting his paces to make sure he was in the right spot. But Donette Wilt was nowhere to be found. Chris walked back and forth convinced that he was in the wrong spot, but he soon realized his suspicions had been correct. The stab wounds Donette had suffered had narrowly missed her vital organs, and incredibly, she managed to drag herself to the nearby highway before flagging down assistance. Surgeons at the Soldiers and Sailors Hospital saved the young girl's life, and she was able to inform police that Chris was headed for the Canadian border. Meanwhile, in an attempt to escape the country, Chris took 33-year-old Beth Dodge hostage at the Eastview Mall in Victor and had Tina follow the pair in their hostage's Pontiac Firebird. After just a short drive, Chris walked Beth to a gravel pit at gunpoint, then shot her in the back of the head, execution style. After turning north, Chris showed a bizarre turn of heart and let Tina go near Boston Logan Airport after giving her enough cash to buy a plane ticket to LA. It seems fairly obvious why Chris chose to spare Tina, given how integral she'd been during the two previous abductions, but it still stands as a stark change of character from a man whose assurance of safety always led to betrayal. Many have suspected that Tina developed a kind of Stockholm syndrome while in Chris's company, which might have manifested in a warped kind of support and affection. Chris might have genuinely believed that Tina was on his side, and it appears this broke through his psychopathic desire to kill as evidence in her eventual release. Upon returning to her family, Tina spent many years in therapy trying to undo the psychological damage inflicted during her ordeal. Finally, on April 13th, Chris stopped at Vic's Getty service station in Colebrook, New Hampshire. He parked his car, walked inside, grabbed a soda, and then asked the clerk directions to the Canadian border while he paid. But then, on the way back to his car, Chris spotted two New Hampshire state troopers approaching him from across the parking lot. He tried to stay as cool as possible, walking calmly back to his vehicle as the two troopers began asking him to stop. Chris opened his driver's side door, back still facing the two troopers, and grabbed a .357 Colt Python from under the seat. However, Trooper Leo Jellison anticipated the move, rushing forward and wrapping a bear hug around Chris in an attempt to prevent him from arming himself. The two men spun around, and since Chris still had the revolver in his grip, Trooper Wayne Fortier felt his life was in imminent danger, and Fortier fired two shots. The first smashed its way through Wilder's chest, punched out of his back, and embedded itself into Trooper Jellison's torso. The second shot impacted Chris's armpit and passed all the way through his chest cavity before exiting the opposite side. His heart, lungs, and dozens of major blood vessels were pulverized, and he died at the scene just minutes later. Trooper Jellison, on the other hand, survived the incident and went to make a hero's return to the New Hampshire State Troopers. His quick thinking had potentially saved the lives of himself, his colleagues, and dozens of other innocent people. When the news of Chris Wilder's apprehension and death hit the airwaves, the sense of relief among both law enforcement and civilian communities was palpable. Chris had already killed or attacked 8 young women during his 6-week spree, and while the police speculated that he'd killed countless more, some incredibly disturbing details began to emerge regarding his character. When police searched the car Chris had been driving at the time of his death, they found a copy of John Fowle's novel called The Collector. It provided a harrowing insight into the mind of a dangerously demented person and made it all the more satisfying that he was no longer walking the earth. Following Chris's cremation back in Florida, he left behind an estate worth more than $7 million. It was decided this fortune should be evenly distributed among the families of his victims, and in June of 1986, each family received a check worth more than $500,000. But no amount of money can bring back a loved one snatched away by the hand of evil. On the morning of June 2nd, 1985, San Francisco police officer Daniel Wright received a rather unusual call regarding a potential shoplifter. The vast majority of shoplifting calls came from pharmacies and grocery stores. However, this one came from a lumberyard in the southern portion of the city. Upon his arrival, Officer Wright was approached by two men, the lumberyard's owner and a large Caucasian man with a long black beard. The store's owner explained that the bearded man's Asian American companion had attempted to steal a bench vise, The bearded man then profusely apologized on behalf of his Asian friend and explained that he'd pay for the stolen bench vise in full. According to the store's owner, the Asian man had placed the stolen bench vise in the trunk of a nearby Honda Prelude before running off. The bearded man claimed that he'd borrowed the vehicle from a friend, but since the car had already been used in the commission of a crime, Officer Wright was entitled to search it. This made the bearded man slightly nervous, but he did not object. In the Honda's trunk, Officer Wright found a black drawstring bag containing a loaded .22 revolver, along with what appeared to be a homemade silencer. Since silencers are illegal in the state of California, when confronted with it, the bearded man insisted it belonged to the vehicle's owner, a man named Lonnie Bond. Officer Wright then detailed the bearded man and put him in cuffs before heading back to his vehicle. There, he checked both the Honda's license plate number and the .22 serial number. The vehicle did indeed belong to Alani Bond, but the revolver was registered to a 26-year-old resident of San Diego named Robin S. Stapley. Officer Wright then got out of his car, walked back over to the bearded man, who by this point was leaning against the Honda, and asked him to produce some ID. The bearded man then produced the ID of Robin S. Stapley. The only problem was, the bearded man and the man on the ID didn't look anything alike. Officer Wright immediately placed the man under arrest, read him his rights, and drove his prisoner to the South City Police Station. In one of the station's interrogating rooms, Officer Wright raised a point of inquiry with the bearded man. He wanted to know why the Honda's license plate was registered to Alani Bond, but the car itself appeared to be owned by a man named Paul Cosner. Cosner had been reported missing to the FSPD more than 9 months prior and had not resurfaced since. So naturally, Officer Wright was very interested to know how the bearded man had come into possession of his car. As the officer spoke, the bearded man grew visibly pale and then made it clear that he wouldn't be answering any more questions. Instead, he requested a pen and a piece of paper. Assuming his prisoner was about to write a confession, Officer Wright fulfilled the man's request. However, upon receiving the writing implements, the bearded man appeared to write a brief note to his wife. When Officer Wright told the bearded man that he could have the note delivered for him, he appeared to ignore the statement entirely. "My friend's name is Charlie Chita Nya," he said. Officer Wright began to make a note of what the bearded man said and asked him to repeat the suspect's unfamiliar-sounding surname. Again, the bearded man seemed to ignore him and continued with what he had to say. "My name isn't really Rob Stapley either," he said. "It's Leonard Lake, and I'm wanted by the FBI. At that, Officer Wright looked up, stunned into silence by the admission. But as he got out of his chair, intent on informing his superiors, Leonard Lake spoke up again. "I didn't think a lousy bench vise would bring me to this," Lake said, a quiver of fear in his voice. The quiver set Officer Wright's nerves on edge, and he turned around just in time to see Leonard Lake placing a small white pill on his tongue. As Officer Wright ran out in the hallway, the sound of "he just swallowed something" echoed throughout the station. As half a dozen other officers rushed into the interview room, there was Lake, his eyes rolling into their sockets, foam dripping from his lips, gripped by agonizing spasms as he convulsed on the carpeted floor. Leonard Lake was rushed to the hospital, and although the doctors managed to save his life, the cyanide he'd ingested was wreaking havoc on his central nervous system. It was later determined that Lake had taped two cyanide capsules to the underside of his shirt lapel, but the question remained, what had Lake done that was so terrible that he'd rather suffer death than face justice? Within just a few hours, the seized Honda Prelude that Lake appeared to have been driving was discovered to have bloodstains on the front passenger seat, along with a small bullet hole near the sun visor. The vehicle's owner, 39-year-old Paul Cosner, disappeared on November 2, 1984, after telling his girlfriend that he was meeting with a weird-looking guy regarding the purchase of a car. What's more, the man whose ID card Lake was in possession of, Robin S. Stapley, was also a missing person, having vanished in April of 1983. The personal effects of several other missing people were also recovered from the Honda. Additionally, the police recovered a Pacific Gas and Electric bill in the name of Clara Lynn Balash. Clara was none other than Leonard Lake's ex-wife. On June 3, 1985, two San Francisco missing person detectives, Tom Eisenman and Irene Brunn, stopped by her home in Bruna to ask her a few questions. It turned out that the energy bill wasn't for Clara's permanent residence. Instead, it was related to a remote cabin her father owned near San Andreas in Calaveras County. She hadn't visited the cabin in years, and neither had her father, but her ex-husband was there frequently, she just didn't know why. The next day, Clara accompanied the two detectives to the cabin and granted them permission to conduct a search. The first thing the detectives noticed as they walked into the cabin's main sitting area was a huge spray of dried reddish-brown substance on the ceiling. There was also a large painting of a forest vista scene covering one wall, a painting which had what looked like a single bullet hole puncturing the canvas. One of the cabin's two bedrooms contained a filthy-looking king-sized bed that had electrical cords tied to each of its posts. Above it hung a 250-watt floodlight that had been fastened to the ceiling. Back in the sitting room, Detective Brunn noticed something curious about a set of blank cassette tapes. The serial numbers on each and every one of them had been scratched off with something small and sharp. As the two detectives departed the property, they noticed a large incinerator in what passed for the cabin's backyard. Just feet away was a large iron trap door that appeared to lead down into some kind of bunker. Clara Balash claimed that she didn't have access to the bunker, but she did know someone who did, her ex-husband's former business partner, Charles Ng. There was just one problem. Clara had driven Charles to San Francisco Airport after he had suddenly and vehemently requested she do so. Suddenly, things started to make more sense for Clara Lynn, and she realized both her husband and his partner Charles had done something terrible. She agreed to be interviewed the following day, and after arriving at the station in a state of visible distress, she told the two detectives everything she knew. Clara had first met Leonard at a Renaissance fair in Marin County, and they married after dating for just a short while. To her knowledge, Leonard had only two friends in the entire world. One, a 5'8", 400-pound Swede by the name of Charles Gunner, was the best man at their wedding. The other was a migrant from Hong Kong named Charles Ng. According to Clara, Charles had simply appeared one day and announced that Leonard had given him permission to move into their family home. The news came as something of a surprise to Clara, and as you can imagine, she wasn't best pleased with her husband. But Leonard assured her Charles would be staying for a few days, as they were partnered on some kind of business venture. Both men had served in the U.S. Marine Corps and struck up an instant friendship as a result. A few days soon turned into a few weeks, and a few weeks became 5 long months before Charles finally departed. Clara was glad to see him depart, but just a few days later, Charles returned in the dead of night before Leonard helped him unload some crates into a shed in the backyard. The next morning, an FBI SWAT team raided the property at the break of dawn, dragging Charles and Leonard out of their beds before carting them off to the nearest federal holding facility. They were charged with the theft of $30,000 worth of military equipment from a U.S. military base in Hawaii. Leonard's 400-pound friend paid his bail, but Charles was still technically a serving member of the Marine Corps. As a result, he ended up doing 18 months in Leavenworth after a dishonorable discharge. Leonard hid out in the mountains until the pair could be reunited, and upon Charles' release, they moved into his father-in-law's cabin out in Calaveras County. Despite being owned by her family, Clara claimed to have no idea what Leonard and Charles had been up to at the cabin, and became angry when one of the detectives appeared to imply that she did. She immediately denied further access to the cabin and told the detectives not to contact her again. But it was too late. The FBI had all it needed to secure an immediate, all-encompassing search warrant. In coordination with the San Francisco Police Department, the Calaveras County Sheriff's Department organized a search team of 17 men. On the morning of June 4, 1985, the search began in earnest. An initial examination of the area surrounding the locked, reinforced bunker revealed a cleared area 10 feet in diameter that showed traces of lye and contained articles of clothing. Fearing they discovered some kind of mass grave, the search team sectioned off the area until forensic specialists could arrive, then set about completing other tasks. One of these tasks included walking over to neighboring properties to talk to the people who lived there. One such home seemed empty, but after contacting the owner, he was told that it was impossible. Bo Carter, the homeowner, explained it was a rental property and a young family should have been living there. Granted, he hadn't heard from them in a while and they were late on their rent, but the landlord hadn't heard any bad news. The sheriff's deputies then asked the landlord for the names of the tenants. Brenda O'Connor, he replied, and her partner's name is Lonnie Bond. The following day, the police task force cracked open the underground bunker and carefully ventured inside. The main room was a 20-foot by 12-foot workshop, complete with a wide variety of hand tools and power saws hanging on one of the walls. Many of these tools appeared to be streaked with blood, and sitting on a table was a broken bench vise. Upon inspection of a second, smaller room, the police soon discovered a large concealed chamber hidden behind a door disguised as a plywood rack. Inside was another double bed, and carved into the wooden headboard was the words Operation Miranda. It was later discovered that this was a reference to the novel The Collector by John Fowles, a copy of which happened to be sitting on a nightstand beside the double bed. The story tells of a malevolent butterfly collector who kidnaps a young woman before locking her in a cellar. The book does not have a happy ending. The captive girl plans an escape but dies of an unexpected illness before she's able. Her captor lovingly buries her in his garden and then plans the kidnap of another victim. A room seemingly connected to a small holding cell contained a variety of old military gear. There were uniforms, boots, and a vast array of Vietnam-era firearms, including M16 and M14 assault rifles, Mossberg shotguns, and M60 light machine guns. On the wall facing the holding cell was a small, soundproofed window complete with a Vietnam-era night vision scope. It was obviously intended to use in observing captives during low-light conditions, and having their captors aware of their every action undoubtedly terrified those imprisoned there. The small observation and equipment room was also covered in a variety of candid photographs, each depicting a young woman in a state of undress. It was quite clear that each of these photographs had been taken inside or within close proximity to the bunker, and the looks on each of the girls' faces were ones of abject terror. Some of the photographs depicted subjects standing in front of a backdrop depicting numerous cartoon figures. The significance of this wouldn't be realized until later in the investigation, when a detective was tasked with tracking down the girls in the pictures. He carried copies of the less obscene photos with him during the investigation and often showed people he interviewed, hoping that they might recognize them. At one point, the detective showed one of the photographers to a man, only to detect an immediate flash of recognition in his eyes. To the detective's frustration, the man didn't recognize the girl, but he did recognize the cartoon backdrop. The witness used to work at South City Juvenile Hall and had seen that exact same wallpaper on a nearly daily basis throughout their employment. Law enforcement then analyzed the institution's employee records, expecting to find either Leonard Lake or Charles Ng's name buried away somewhere. They found neither, but they did spot another name they recognize: Clara Lynn Balish, Leonard Lake's ex-wife. On the second day of searching Lake's cabin, a small notebook was found concealed in one of the bedrooms. A forensic analyst carefully examined the notebook using gloves and a pair of tweezers, being careful not to smudge any fingerprints or dislodge any hair fibers. It was a journal written in a style and pattern identical to Leonard Lake's, and as the investigators began to read, his jaw just about hit the floor. Almost every page of the small paperback notebook was filled with what amounted to half confession and half manifesto, making for utterly terrifying reading. Leonard was terrified of nuclear war and believed that an apocalyptic exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was imminent. This is why the cabin first drew his interest, as a remote concealed place of residence would be the perfect place to construct a survival bunker. Leonard also seemed to have pondered the question of repopulation in the event of a nuclear apocalypse and planned to turn the Calaveras County bunker, along with many across the country, into what amounted to baby factories. The only thing he was missing is what Leonard referred to as breeding stock. The following day, investigators found yet another concealed holding cell in the underground bunker. The tiny room contained just a narrow bed, a chemical toilet, an air freshener, and a water container, with small holes drilled into the wall to provide just enough ventilation to keep a prisoner alive. Just hours into the third day of the search, the forensics team received an unexpected visitor in the form of none other than Leonard Lake's mother. Gloria Eberling informed the ranking officer on the scene that she hadn't heard from her son in quite some time and was deeply concerned about his well-being. Sheriff Ballard was then compelled to deliver the news that Leonard Lake had passed away, a result of the cyanide that he had ingested on the day of his arrest. Gloria took the news terribly and had to be escorted from the site. For Ballard, it was just another point of tension in a case that was rapidly becoming a complete nightmare. What had started as a shoplifting call had somehow transformed into multiple kidnappings, violations, and murders, with one of their suspects dead by taking their own life, and another being an ex-Marine with family all over the world. On the fourth day of the search, literally hundreds of personal items belonging to dozens of different people were recovered from a large trench that had been dug near the bunker. However, it wasn't until the early hours of the following morning that the first bodies were discovered. The skeletal remains of two people were carefully removed from the soil and reassembled at a makeshift coroner's station. But the process was slow, and during this time, the police made another chilling discovery. In the early afternoon, a sealed 5-gallon bucket was extracted from the earth. Police found it contained various personal items from people they could only assume were victims, along with two VHS tapes labeled M. Ladies, Kathy/Brenda. While the other personal items were sorted according to their owners, the VHS tapes were taken to the local sheriff's department for viewing. However, the tape's content shook the deputies to their core. One tape showed a young woman identified only as Brenda, chained to a chair and begging for information about the health of her infant child. Lake was then heard telling her, "Your baby is sound asleep, like a rock." The second victim shown on the tape was 19-year-old Brenda O'Connor, Leonard's missing neighbor who had been living in a nearby home. Based on what was said in the video, deputies deduced that Lonnie Bond and their young son, Lonnie Jr., had been murdered before the recording was made. When the search concluded, the team had uncovered the remains of 7 men, 3 women, and 2 infant children, along with 45 pounds of unidentified bone fragments. In total, the police suspected that up to 25 bodies were buried around the cabin and the accompanying bunker. It was a veritable charnel house, a place where 2 incredibly sadistic serial murderers had been operating with complete impunity for almost 2.5 years. While Sheriff Ballard and his team worked around the clock to recover the victim's remains, the FBI took over the search for the missing Charles Ng. Charles was born in the British territory of Hong Kong on Christmas Eve of 1961. He grew up as the son of a wealthy businessman, in the lap of luxury with every opportunity he could ever ask for. However, Charles developed something of a rebellious streak. He was expelled from several schools throughout his teenage years. To straighten him out, Charles' father sent him to an extremely strict, upper-class boarding school in the English county of Yorkshire. Charles' paternal uncle was one of the school's science teachers, and it was hoped that being taken under his wing would improve his behavior. Instead, Charles only got worse. He appeared to develop a severe case of kleptomania, stealing incessantly from the school, his fellow pupils, and a department store in the nearest town. In the end, the school that was supposed to reform him was forced to exclude him on the grounds that he was simply not capable of reforming himself. Charles returned to Hong Kong and spent the next few years making trouble for his parents. When they threatened to cut him off entirely, he obtained a student visa to study in the United States, but dropped out of Belmont, California's Notre Dame College after just 1 semester in late 1977. In late 1979, Charles enlisted in the United States Marine Corps, lying about his place of birth and claiming to be a native of Bloomfield, Indiana. Never one to talk themselves out of a potential recruit, the Marines accepted his application. For the first time in his life, Charles must have felt like he belonged somewhere. The Marines provided him with the discipline that had eluded him all of his life, and he excelled in almost all of his duties. By 1981, Charles had been promoted to the rank of Lance Corporal, but a steady slip in discipline led to a return to old habits. Just months after he was promoted, Charles stole crates upon crates full of rifles and hand grenades, intent on selling them to organized crime groups. Within days of being caught, Charles managed to escape military custody and then made his way to California, where he eventually met Leonard Lake. At the age of 19, Lake left a privileged but somewhat unstable home and enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. He trained as a radar operator and was soon deployed to combat during Vietnam. However, the stresses of counterinsurgency warfare had a devastating effect on Lake's psyche, and he eventually received treatment for exhibiting incipient psychotic reactions. Following his psychiatric treatment, he was once again deemed fit for combat, but his second tour of duty was cut short after a matter of months on the grounds that Lake was suffering from unspecified medical problems. After receiving the Vietnam Service Medal, a Vietnam Campaign Medal, and two other medals for good conduct, Lake was discharged on medical grounds and settled in San Jose, California. He briefly attended San Jose State University, but dropped out at around the same time he started mental health treatment at the Oakland Veterans Administration Hospital. A few years later, the fateful Renaissance Fair meeting occurred, where Leonard would meet his future wife, Clara Lynn, while running a stall in which he disguised a goat as a unicorn. They married in 1981 and then moved to Mendocino County, Northern California. It was here that Lake became obsessed with survivalism and the outcome of a global nuclear conflict. Following the discovery of the bunker and after boarding an American Airlines flight to Chicago, Charles Nguyen checked into the Chateau Hotel under the name Mike Komodo. After 4 days, he moved to Detroit, then crossed the border to Canada in the dead of night. He eluded a continental manhunt for 34 days, but, much like the California lumberyard, his penchant for petty theft proved his undoing. On Saturday, July 6, 1985, two security guards working in a grocery store in Calgary noticed an Asian man trying to steal several food items. When confronted, the man pulled out a small pistol and threatened to kill them if they didn't back off. Instead of complying, the two security officers tackled him. During the altercation, one officer was shot through the hand. The assailant was later charged at the Calgary Metropolitan Police Station with robbery, attempted robbery, possession of a firearm, and attempted murder. However, when news of his arrest reached the United States and it became clear that the man was Charles Nguyen, there was little celebration. U.S. authorities were aware that due to a 1976 extradition treaty with the United States, Canada would refuse to extradite any prisoner charged with a capital crime that carried the death penalty. While diplomats tried to secure his extradition, two San Francisco detectives interviewed Nguyen in his Calgary jail cell. Charles claimed that Leonard Lake was the mastermind behind most of the bunker murders, but confessed to assisting in the dismemberment and disposal of Paul Cosner's body. As Nguyen faced a 4.5-year sentence for armed robbery in Canada, the U.S. justice system began the lengthy extradition process. It took nearly 6 years, but on September 26, 1991, the Canadian government handed him over to American authorities. Hours after his release in Canada, Charles was incarcerated in California's Folsom Prison. However, with his knowledge of American criminal law, he managed to delay his trial for another 7 years. Finally, in October 1998, Charles Chita Nguyen's trial began. Over the subsequent months, the jury was presented with evidence detailing how Leonard and Charles selected, kidnapped, and imprisoned their victims at a cabin. There, the victims were abused, tortured, and killed. The jury were shown sections of the VHS tapes which depicted the abuse and torture of Kathy Allen and Brenda O'Connor. The prosecutor attempted to also show them extracts from Leonard's journal, which documented his fears of the coming apocalypse and his desire to repopulate the earth. But the presiding judge refused, arguing Lake's personal opinions bore no relevancy to the case. Charles' defense attorney argued that he was an unwilling accomplice and only cooperated with Leonard out of fear for his life. The jury saw through the defense and at the conclusion of his trial in February of 1999, they found Charles guilty on 11 counts of murder. Charles was subsequently sentenced to death, with the presiding judge immediately rejecting a motion to reduce the sentence to life imprisonment instead. Many have suggested that on their own, Charles and Leonard were nothing but discontented loners, but together, they formed what psychologists might call a gestalt. Essentially, they egged each other on, enabling and cultivating each other's darker tendencies, until finally, they crossed a psychological red line that allowed them to kidnap, violate, and murder without remorse. Many have argued that this red line came in the form of Donald Lake, Leonard's younger brother. The 32-year-old suffered severe mental problems as the result of a train accident when he was just a child. He was described as a mild-mannered, gentle young man, but became the subject of Leonard's increasing ire as he entered his early 30s. Leonard once described him as a leech, and in a roundabout way, told Clara Lynn Balish that he didn't deserve to live. Shortly afterwards, Leonard stopped by his mother's house, claiming that he could find him work as a house sitter in San Francisco. Donald was never seen again. It's quite clear that Leonard was able to justify Donald's murder through a twisted perception of ownership of him, a logic he no doubt applied to his other victims. After all, if someone can delude themselves into believing their actions are saving humanity, it's frightening to consider the atrocities they can commit. Born on November 6th of 1955, Alton Coleman was born in a small, low-income town around 30 miles north of Chicago, Illinois. He had a rough childhood, with a penchant for wetting himself resulting in the cruel schoolyard nickname of Pissy. The humiliation caused Alton to become a quiet, reserved child who preferred solitude to the company of others. Yet it wasn't just the severe bullying that led Alton to lead a lonesome existence. He knew he was different, even as a young child, said a close family friend. Then as he grew up, he got interested in some insidious things. By the time Alton was a teenager, he was known to local police as something of a troublemaker, due to his habit of smashing his neighbor's windows at the Waukegan housing project he called home. As Alton grew older, his penchant for criminality continued, but unlike many of his law-breaking peers, Alton had a knack for beating the system. "He was good at conning jurors," said Waukegan Police Lieutenant Mark Hansen. "He was smooth as silk, could tell a good story in court. He knew how to make himself look like a decent person. He was conniving like that, a real career criminal." Yet Alton didn't keep himself out of prison by just fooling juries. He was adept in all manners of witness intimidation, too. Bizarrely, many of the people Alton assaulted and robbed over the years were convinced that he was a practitioner of ancient voodoo magic. Yet it also seems that at some point, Alton stopped just talking about curses and vengeful spirits, and began to legitimately believe in them. By 1983, Alton's use of drugs and alcohol had caused a stark deterioration in his mental health. Exacerbated by a feverish belief in the power of voodoo, Alton began to display symptoms of several serious psychiatric conditions, terrorizing his family, friends, and neighbors. At one point, Alton's sister reported him to the police after he savagely beat and attempted to violate his own 8-year-old niece. 3 weeks later, she dropped the charges, stating that there had been a misunderstanding, but the state continued the prosecution on account of how severe the charges were. However, with the victim unable to take the stand and the star witness refusing to testify, the state had no choice but to halt their prosecution, but not before the presiding judge decided to offer his professional opinion. "I think the woman as she stands here today is terrified of this man," he said, and implied that she was somehow covering for Alton when he referred to her version of events completely implausible. It marked the fifth time Alton had been the number one suspect in an assault case, yet once again, he managed to dodge a conviction. Finally, in early 1983, Alton discovered he was wanted in connection with the violation and murder of a girl from the Chicago suburbs, and he went on the run. It's more than likely Alton knew that he'd be convicted, and since murder in Illinois still carried the death penalty back then, he knew he wasn't long for this world. What resulted was one of the most hideous and violent crime sprees in all of U.S. history, and it begins with a young woman named Deborah Brown. Deborah had no history of criminality prior to meeting Alton and was engaged to another man before he convinced her to call off the engagement. There's no doubt that she was madly in love with him, but there's also no doubt that Alton subjected Deborah to horrendous physical and emotional abuse. She was one of 11 children, the daughter of an abusive alcoholic father and a heroin addict mother who suffered serious head trauma when she was an infant. As a result, Deborah was slightly slower than her other siblings, and her struggles would result in vicious beatings at the hands of Alton Coleman. Being a known associate of his, Deborah was questioned by police in connection with Alton's whereabouts on June 1st of 1984. She denied all knowledge of his location, then immediately reported back to him. Then on June 5th, they vanished from the city of Chicago. Using fraudulent identification, the couple rented a small apartment in Gary, Indiana, and for the next 2 weeks, they attempted to lie low. But then, on June 18th, 7-year-old Tamika Turks and her 9-year-old aunt went missing while on a routine trip to a nearby convenience store. The older girl was found alive but in critical condition just a few hours later, but little Tamika remained missing. The following morning, the 7-year-old's lifeless corpse was found in an area of woodland just outside of Gary. Someone had quite literally stomped her to death. When the 9-year-old awoke in the hospital, she gave a harrowing account of what had occurred. After being abducted at knife point by an older male and female, the 9-year-old had been forced to watch as they held her young niece down and repeatedly jumped on her chest and stomach. The damage fractured ribs and punctured vital organs, leaving the young girl with no chance of survival. The couple then proceeded to brutally beat and torture the older girl, but for some reason chose to leave her alive. She now suffers extreme trauma as a result of the incident and is said to endure debilitating flashbacks. "She will get to screaming and crying like someone is hitting her on the back of the head," said Mary Hillard, the child's mother, while Tamika's mother was forced to leave Indiana altogether to escape such painful memories. Just a few hours after Tamika Turk's body was found, 25-year-old Donna Williams was reported missing by her parents. 2 days later, another woman was taken hostage on the outskirts of Detroit by a couple matching Alton and Deborah's description. The only reason she escaped with her life was because she bluffed the pair into thinking she'd crashed the car at high speeds, killing them all in the process. Alton and Deborah went on to rob several other people before finally fleeing Detroit, triggering an interstate manhunt of epic proportions. Yet the couple proved extremely difficult to track. Not only did they make a habit of befriending Good Samaritans, who'd often conceal them from the long arm of the law, but they'd sometimes confuse law enforcement by carjacking someone and quickly abandoning the stolen car, almost as if though they knew it would throw the cops off their scent. By the time Donna Williams' body was found in an abandoned house near Wayne State University, Alton and Deborah had reached Toledo, Ohio. From there, the couple veered southward towards Cincinnati, murdering a woman named Marlene Waters in the basement of her own home. Her husband was later found badly beaten, but alive, in another apparent bid to leave one victim alive but traumatized by the death of their loved one, whose murder they were no doubt forced to witness. Marlene Waters' car was found abandoned just a few days later in a cornfield just outside of Lexington, Kentucky. Alton and Deborah had abandoned it there to give law enforcement the impression that they were hiding out in Lexington, but in reality, they veered off to nearby Williamsburg to continue their crime spree. On Monday, July 16th of 1984, a political science professor named Olin Carmichael was making his way back to his hotel room after a long day of lectures and seminars. Olin wasn't local to the area and had been staying in a hotel room during his temporary tenure at Baptist College in the Kentucky Mountains. He drove into the hotel's parking lot, shut off his engine, and then got out and locked the door. But then the moment he turned around from doing so, he saw two guns pointed in his face. "They told me, 'We want your money and all of it. Is your life worth more than your money?' Olin later said. He knew better than to talk back, and proceeded to hand over his wallet, his car keys, as well as any spare change that he had. But just when Olin thought that the robbers were done with him, they popped the trunk of his car and then told him to get in. Alton and Deborah drove the terrified professor into Lexington, Kentucky, then stopped in a secluded area to shake him down. "Who loves you enough to get some paper, though?" he was asked. Olin replied that his wife might be able to get some money together, so Alton forced him to call her from a payphone. He was ordered to tell her that he had a gambling debt and was going to be killed if he didn't bring every penny that she could muster to a phone booth in downtown Richmond, Kentucky. Alton said they'd call again once they were on location, but for some reason, they abandoned the car on the I-75 with Olin still in the trunk. He had no idea why they didn't stick around to collect the money, which Olin's wife was only too willing to hand over. The move was yet another distraction, and the bodies of two victims were discovered back in Ohio. Alton and Deborah progressed to Indianapolis, where they murdered 75-year-old Eugene Scott before stealing his car. After a 53-day rampage, Alton and Deborah made their way back to Waukegan area on July 20th. This seems like an incredibly bizarre move given how notorious they were by that period, but for some reason, they chose to stroll around a local park before watching a pickup basketball game. They were recognized within minutes of sitting down at the bleachers, and under the guise of slipping away to buy a soda, one of their fellow attendees rushed to call the cops. Within a half hour, the entirety of Mason Park was crawling with police officers, yet when they revealed themselves and rushed in to make the arrest, Alton barely flinched. "You got the wrong man, officer," he told one of the cops as he calmly cooperated. Deborah Brown kept quiet, identifying herself only as Dennis Johnson when asked to do so. Each seemed to think that they'd be able to talk their way out of being arrested, but when a loaded pistol and lock knife were found in their possession, their detention was assured. When news of the arrest hit the headlines, the entire Midwest breathed a deep collective sigh of relief. Those who'd witnessed the arrest said Alton appeared exhausted and underweight compared to his wanted poster, and police even speculated that the brazen attempt to watch a ball game was their own way of giving themselves up. After all, this was a couple who seemed to have mastered the arts of diversion, distraction, and evasion, and as one police officer put it, it was like they'd just run out of steam. Upon their arrival at the nearest police station, Alton and Deborah were questioned separately, but each invoked their right to remain silent. Yet after each were transferred to a federal holding facility, and the severity of their situation hit home, Deborah Brown agreed to talk. Over the course of an in-depth 2-hour interview, Deborah gave a full and frank account of their violent crime spree, but despite cooperating with authorities, the severity of her crimes were too severe to warrant life imprisonment. She was eventually sentenced to die for the murder she'd committed and was confined to the all-female death row of Indiana's state prison system. Alton shared the same fate and was executed by lethal injection at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility on April 26th of 2002 at the age of 46 years old. He spent his last days appealing his death sentence, but despite one such appeal making it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, he received no clemency. Relatives of the couple's victims were able to watch the death sentence being carried out via a secured television link, but no recording was made of the event. For his last meal, Alton ordered a filet mignon with sautéed mushrooms, fried chicken breasts, cornbread, biscuits and brown gravy, French fries, broccoli with cheese, salad with French dressing, onion rings, collard greens, sweet potato pie with whipped cream, butter pecan ice cream, and a cherry Coke. The observation room overlooking the execution chamber in Lucasville holds just 12 people, with a concertina door separating the convicts' witnesses from those representing the victims. Alton Coleman invited a spiritual advisor along with his legal team, meaning the small observation room was even more crowded than usual. At 10 a.m., Alton walked into the death chamber wearing a non-denominational prayer shawl with crosses and stars of David over his prison blues. After lying calmly on the execution gurney, he appeared to say something to the observers, but thanks to the chamber's thick glass, they couldn't hear him. He remained still as the guards fastened restraints on him and then attached the lines that would contain the three chemicals to a cannula that had already been fixed to his arm. A prison official asked if he had any final words, but Alden simply shook his head before the execution process began. Although just three chemicals are used to execute a prisoner, one to induce unconsciousness, another to stop breathing, and a third to stop the heart, a total of 8 syringes operate automatically once the button is pushed. It often takes 2 or 3 very long minutes for all the syringes to empty, and as the drugs began flowing, Alton began reciting the 23rd Psalm. By the time he reached, "He leadeth me beside the still waters," the sodium pentothal began to take effect, and he lost consciousness. Finally, he was pronounced dead at exactly 10:30 a.m. It was the end to a deeply painful chapter in the lives of his victims' families, many of whom faced a long and heart-wrenching journey back to normalcy. The grandmother of 7-year-old Tamika Turk said survivors would never know peace. "We'll never be the same," she said, "because what they took from us, they cannot give back." Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern, and there are some super fun live streams every Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday night. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks of becoming a member on the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations and save huge on data, located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, don't read The Collector.